Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to Books Boys, live from the Grand Library, the Dean and PJ.
Guys, keep calm and read your Dickens. PJ, we're using the Anna Karenina method here. He's PJ.
Hello there.
I'm the Dean, and we are the Books Boys.
The one and only.
This is the Books Boys show. Get it? Buy it? Books.
Books. What is it all about?
There we go. We nailed that intro.
We nailed that intro after all the practice. And but honestly, seriously, what is a book actually? So I've been trying to investigate it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've gone past the toilet section and the supermarket. I believe it might be in the salad section because they're made out of trees, right? You know, books are made out of trees, right?
It's
made
good
out
thinking, good thinking, yeah.
So I thought maybe between the salads, you know, I'm a big salad eater myself.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe between the lettuce, there might be verses, T.S. Eliot and, you know, all the good boys.
Now, PJ, I'm not happy here. You've spent a long time lingering in the toilet paper aisle, and you know you're actually vegan. You eat a plant-based diet. Why is it taking you 2.5 years to make it over to the salad aisle for us?
Well, I think the thing is I might have been eating the books, hence there hasn't been always as much as you. You've always read more. Except one time, I think we had one episode where I read more.
There was once, yeah.
But those are kids' books, so yeah, it was a bit different.
So there, long-term storytelling, we figured it out. It's because you've been eating the books all along.
I think that's what it is. It's vegan after, isn't it? It's ink.
Yeah,
well, I don't know if the ink is vegan, but you know. But anyway. So anyway, that must be it, guys. So look between the salad for the new plays by the good lads, whoever you want to read next, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe a bit of Poe or a bit of, you know, whatever you want to read. I think it might be in the salad section.
I should mention as well, we're joined by Little Alfred. Here he is. Now, a lot of the UK is going on strike tomorrow over their salaries, and Alfred will be joining them. I'm very sorry that we could not fulfill his desires, but he's here with us for today anyway.
Shocking stuff. Shocking stuff. Well, I'm glad you're here right now. So I suppose, the strike, this is the 25th of April, the recording date right now.
Mm-hmm.
So the 26th.
That's
so
it.
Anyway, good time to read some books. So hopefully you can always take an opportunity to read books wherever you are, even if it's a time of stress.
I will certainly be reading nice. Tomorrow.
That's nice.
And I'll be going to see some Molière. I'll be going to see Tartuffe with Playboy Alex.
Very nice indeed. It's a bit of culture as well. That's lovely.
Mm-hmm.
And what about you then? What have you been doing this month?
I've been doing a lot. So I'm going to see Tartuffe and also a Sister Sledge concert. What else have I done this month? I went to see an English indie band, Razorlight.
And also, what about Athens? Because we didn't talk, you know, the last...
Oh, yeah, that's right. We didn't really catch up on that.
No.
Alex and I talked about it on Playboys. But yeah, Alex and I, we went to Athens. We had a great time. We saw Athens itself for a couple of days. We did Corinth. We did Delphi to see the Oracle there. It was a fantastic time. We saw lots of monuments, lots of culture, ate a lot of Greek food. It was brilliant, yeah. And, you know, there's more to do. We didn't do Sparta because really there's nothing there to see anymore. It's just a village. But we realized that there would still be some places we'd like to see. And we were recommended, you know, some of the islands, also like Thessaloniki up in, I think it's in the north. So you would need to visit Greece a few times to see like all the nice parts, you know.
So, right, okay. So maybe this is your new thing. You're moving on from the Spain aficionado Spanish chat to the more Greek kind of
Well, you
oriented
say
chat.
that, but I'm actually visiting Spain in May, June, and July. So,
Shocking stuff, shocking stuff. In fact, you're visiting me in May,
I'm
in
visiting
Las
you in a
Palmas.
three or 4 weeks' time. Yeah.
I do have one or two cultural places to show you that you might like indeed, so I'm just saying.
Nice.
I myself have had 2 weeks off during Easter, and I have just been, what have I been doing? I've just been writing and doing yoga and a lot of beach time and nature time and playing music with Elisa. And we even started mantra circles. We're hopefully doing that every weekend. So if you're in Las Palmas and you want to have some heart connecting mantras and some healing music, come and join us. So that's what we've been doing, refocusing on the music and kind of children books writing. So it's
Nice.
been a lot of fun. And we've had a birthday. So happy
We
birthday to you, Dee.
both had our birthdays. We are now both 31. Yeah.
It's a tender age, I feel. Tender age. No, actually, I feel it's a great age. I've enjoyed it.
Well, I don't
And
know.
enjoy.
I didn't mind turning 30. I was looking forward to turning 30, unlike most people. But I forgot that it was going to continue increasing after that. 30,
Oh,
31 took me totally unawares.
Lord.
But no, it's all good.
And
What else? I did some dance performances with my Mexican dance, dancing some polkas and
oh
some Veracruz. Yeah,
nice.
it's been a busy enough time.
Nice, cool. And what about on the literature sections? I've got one book to talk about this month, but it's some book, I'm telling you. It is, anyway, I'm looking forward to talking about. What
Okay,
about you?
well,
What have you read?
I'm gonna start in what I think it's a good place because I read this one. Well, I was honestly worried that I didn't do enough reading the first part of the month because I was enjoying my trip to Athens, but I caught up. So I read Marcos Chico, El Asesinato de Platón. So this
Hey,
is
again. Oh my
only,
God.
I mean, it's not only available in Spanish, but it's not available in English. I think you can get it in Italian and French, as well as
I think
Spanish.
I have to translate the title, Dean. As usual, you're just assuming that everyone speaks Spanish who listens to this show. So.
I mean, yeah, I would have said the death of Plato, but I guess literally it's the assassination of Plato, but he's not assassinated, so
Yeah. Okay.
this one
That's a
is
quiz.
just under 1,000 pages.
My God. Is this not the sequel to the assassination of Socrates
It
that
is,
you were
which is
talking about?
also just under 1,000 pages, and I
Okay.
actually read it 3 years to the day or to the week, which is interesting.
All right. Okay. Interesting. Very
The
cool.
assassination of Socrates was a gift to me from Valerie the Pigeon Detective, and this one I looked out for a long time for the sequel, and I eventually found it in a bookstore in Madrid.
Wow. Okay.
So, and this guy, he hasn't done much else. He did Pythagoras, Socrates, and Plato, and I think that's really all he's known for. Those
Okay.
three books. But I mean, this is fantastic. What I will say is, if you have any interest, it's a good story with the characters, and there's some drama and there's some romance and intrigue and all the rest of it. But if you have any interest in a little introduction to Greece, it's fantastic because it touches on history, mythology, philosophy. It hits all those points, and it's a good introduction to a lot of things, actually. So there you go, guys.
Nice.
If you ever wanted a nice, easy, breezy introduction to Greek history, just read two 1,000-page books in Spanish,
Exactly, yeah.
and you'll
Exactly.
get
Yeah,
it.
you get it. You get
It's all you got to do.
it. All
So
right.
I have one criticism of the book, actually, which is it starts
Okay.
out a lot with the usual sort of Athens and Sparta dynamic. And then, as you would expect, I guess, with history, Sparta became less relevant. Thebes became more relevant, so it switches over. Thebes becomes relevant in the book. Then it focuses a lot on Sicily, on Syracuse, and Sparta really just drops away. In the second half, they're just not mentioned at all. And I kind of felt like it's a wee, you don't spend the first half of a book focusing a lot on a city that you then just never follow up on. Like it just drops completely out of the narrative.
So don't mention it at all. There's no closure, basically.
It gets mentioned briefly, just like in the epilogue at the very, very end. But they disappear for like 500 pages, and even Thebes kind of drops out. Like it is interesting. It really focuses on Athens and Sicily then, which was the major event. But I still feel like, Sparta didn't just stop; they were still there. It's very interesting that they just don't get mentioned, and we don't follow up on the characters again until, you know, a few lines in the epilogue or whatever.
Okay.
So
yeah, that's a bit of a pity.
That was my criticism. That was a pity. But having said that, I'm gonna be honest, this is a fantastic book. And I do recommend it. It's getting you know, full marks from me. Now, Plato does not get assassinated because Plato was not assassinated.
Okay, so the title is a bit nonsense.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a spoiler for something that happened 2,500 years ago, but Plato does eventually die in like the last two lines of the book. But he just dies peacefully, you know?
Right, okay, what is it called that though? The assassination?
I think they just wanted to follow up on the assassination of Socrates. Like, they wanted to kind of have that theme. Yeah.
Okay.
Look, I've been trying to work this out all month. Maybe they want to say, like, the events of the book caught up with him and it was too much stress and it led to his death. But he also mentions that he was a very old man. He was, like, twice the age Socrates was or something. Like, he was so old. So I don't think that... I think it was natural, you know?
Right, okay.
Not quite twice the age, but you know what I'm saying. So
no, true.
Quick summary of the plot, and honestly, I'm only going to mention about the first 40% of the plot because it's too much, you know, to talk about. Okay. But basically, we have Plato. He's not our main character. He's kind of actually supporting cast, and we have a chap. So there's two families: there's a family in Athens and a family in Sparta who are related, but they don't know, and actually, they never really find out as the book goes on. So it's kind of interesting that that plot doesn't actually go anywhere. There's a girl called Alcaea, and she is the wife of an Athenian chap, Sapphiro. And what's actually happening is, unlike the usual kind of sexist society, Sapphiro gives her a lot of freedom. She goes around, she goes, sees her family and a lot, friends, whatever else. She goes to Plato's classes, and eventually Plato actually lets her become the first female teacher. And she actually teaches classes in the in Plato's academy. And also they made a pact that despite the norm, which was, if we've ever read our Greek court speeches, see Forensic Friends on our Patreon, they mentioned that a Greek man would have a wife, a concubine, and a girlfriend. But they made the rule that he wasn't allowed to sleep with any slaves, he wasn't allowed to cheat on her, quite a modern couple almost. That's the start. So they start with a very happy, attentive couple. But they have a slave girl, Melissa, who's their chief slave, kind of the key holder for the house. And she really likes Sapphiro, and she's hoping that actually she can get with her master and get rid of the wife. She also was the concubine of his father, so she's used to that kind of relationship. And she's the chief antagonist. She's always plotting and scheming, you know, things to do with her master and mistress. She gets her comeuppance and things, don't get me wrong, but there's a lot of scheming and plotting from her. So that's one of the main dynamics. The main dynamic in Sparta is, women were respected in Sparta for their ability to produce warriors, but we have a family here where a woman is producing daughters, and where her husband is a giant brute of a man who basically beats her in front of the kids and is just horrible. So that's the opposing dynamic. And he takes after his dad, who is just exactly the same. He's called Leonidas, by the way. I can't quite remember the wife's name, but that's what's happening there. So the sad thing that happens, the first tragedy of the book, is Alcaea gets pregnant and has a stillborn child. And then we find out that this has happened several times. And they actually tell her, you can't have kids anymore. Like, this one has done too much damage to you. It's you can't have kids. It's done. Sorry. And she says, well, now he's going to, you know, we said he would never cheat on me, but now he might because I can never give him an heir. But actually, in the beginning, the husband's perfectly honorable and he doesn't want to cheat on her. He says, no, we're going to stick, you know, and everyone says, look, that Melissa's really sexy. And he says, no, I'm sticking by my boys, you know. So he's a good chap in the beginning. I'm not going to go into all the ins and outs of it, but basically their entire relationship falls apart not that far into the book. And it's a shame. And they grow estranged and he's, you know, getting off with all manner of slaves. She is, they actually take in a cook to work for them, and she ends up actually dating the slave, actually like having a proper affair with the slave. So the whole thing falls apart, and I really turned on her, and I feel bad for it because I misread something. So it turns out the reason she's having these abortions, or these stillborns, is because Melissa has been poisoning her every time she's pregnant.
Oh, no.
But I misread it and thought she was doing it to herself. Because later she says, I'd love to have a child with the slave. So I thought she had done all of this, but I misread it. And I had to go back and I realized that I was being way too harsh on her. And she's actually, it didn't happen that way at all.
Okay. That's a whole different kind of story, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because I completely flipped the book and I had to go back and be like, this something's not adding
that's
up
what,
here.
That's what happens. That's what happens. Yeah, so reread the stuff first.
But so that's their tragedy. And sorry, I made a mistake. I need to correct myself. The husband is called Calippo. The cook slave is called Saphiro. Okay. A lot of this story is around Plato going to Sicily. That was something that Athens did, and he actually gets imprisoned there. By Dionysius. Now, I've read Plato's letters to Dionysius, by the way. You can read these. They're extant. And he was trying to create the philosopher king. So he had this theory that if a philosopher was also the tyrant or the king, you would have perfection, basically. Dionysius, unfortunately, is not playing ball, but they think his son, Dionysius Jr., might be willing to play ball. And Dion, his uncle, is over there, and Dion is a pupil of Plato's. So he's teaching him philosophy from birth, essentially. So they think, well, your dad imprisoned me, but I'm going to go over now that your dad's dead, and I'm going to make you the philosopher king. And shock, horror, he gets imprisoned again. So he goes to Sicily twice and gets imprisoned twice, because tyrants don't want to give up their power, you know? And once they get the power, no matter how good their intentions were, it just doesn't work.
Doesn't work that way.
And they, you know, Dion gets exiled and everything like that. And there's a lot of politics involved, but it's good to learn the history, you know?
Yeah.
And really, go ahead.
So for a history, so for an ancient history aficionado like yourself, it's a great book, but maybe not for the average reader who's maybe not too interested.
But I think it's a good introduction, you know, because it does it in
a 2000 page introduction.
But it's fun, you know, it's a fun novel. Know. It's not reading Thucydides or something that's maybe a bit drier. Like, it is actually novel.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Okay, cool. So it does a lot of historical kind of portraiture. Okay.
Yeah. In terms of the Spartan family, because they drop off from the narrative, not a lot happens there. Really, the brother-in-law, so the husband's brother ends up having an affair with the wife there, and then it just kind of just drop off the, the narrative. Yeah. It doesn't really go anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, like, it seems a bit too much now.
But, I mean, there's a lot going on, and I really only want to touch a few points, but, there's some horrible scenes of violence and, you know, sexual assault and all this kind of stuff. Altea has a brother who's an addictive gambler, gambles away all of his money, steals from his dad, Eurymachus, gambles away his... So the brother's Eurymachus, sorry. The dad is Piraeus, something like that. But he gambles away all his money, steals from his dad, gambles away more money, actually bets his ancestral home. And of course, the guys say, that's fine, you sign off your ancestral home because your dad might live for years. And then the next day, they go to kill the dad, you know, so... and they get his home, and of course, actually, gallantly, Plato rides to the rescue on horseback,
of course,
and breaks it all up in a scene which I find hard to believe for a philosopher. But Plato gallantly comes to the rescue in a very dashing scene. But
sounds like fan fiction, though. Sounds like you could write, because you're such a big fan of Plato that you just get overhead and just start imagining Plato like some kind of musketeer.
Yeah, so that's a very musketeer-like scene when he comes into the rescue.
Sounds like you would write. You just, like, you know, in a moment of Dumas and Plato absolute devotion, you just wrote a slash buckler novel about Plato.
Yeah.
I can see.
The last thing I want to say is the two things that massively drive the plot are that Altea actually finally has a baby, but not to her husband, to the slave.
Oh, no, that's too much spoiler.
But again, I'm only covering the first, like, less than half of the novel. Maybe that's slightly later, but she has a husband to the slave. What's very important is her husband stops being Mr. Good Guy, and he actually becomes the tyrant of Syracuse after Dionysius. So then he gets completely corrupted as well.
Okay.
And in desperate attempts to get over to see her master that she loves, Melissa puts herself through all manner of tortures to get over there. So I'm going to leave it there. But there's a lot. I mean, I always, although I love the history and the philosophy, I love the romances and the action and the drama with these types of characters. So this book gave me basically everything that I could have hoped for in a novel, you know?
There you go. Like, so you're happy. You're happy, man. You enjoyed your 2,000-word, 2,000-page epos. Yeah.
There's a couple of nice little moments where they say, oh, here's Plato's star pupil, a young Macedonian chap. And, of course, it's Aristotle, you know. And there's another point where a young man's getting educated, and it's a certain Philip of Macedon. And Philip says, oh, these guys are educating me, but I have an idea. What if we don't have Athens or Sparta or Thebes? What if Macedon becomes the leading power in the Greek world? And of course, that's Alexander the Great's father, Philip of Macedon, who started that work. So it's always nice when these books give you those little, you know, it's not even really relevant to the plot, but it's just these little in references to be like, ah, you could have almost written a sequel about that if you'd wanted to, like, you know,
yeah.
These characters. I really like that.
Yeah, cool.
But I think without going into like too many spoilers and everything, I think that's really the best place to stop. A lot of the characters aren't that likable because, I mean, Plato is, but he's not even really the lead, you know. Altea's likable, but then she's, and her husband's likable in the beginning, but they both kind of get a bit bad and they're cheating on each other and everything else. The Spartans aren't really all that likable. The one person who's likable, actually, and Melissa's the villain. It's actually the slave, the cook slave, who has a brief relationship with Melissa before turning to her his master. And when she's in love, Melissa's actually nice for a few months. But yeah, the invulnerable. But the cook, Sephiro, he's the only genuine nice guy. And he goes through some ordeals as well. But he's the only genuine character that you actually really like and you root for, I think, as the novel goes on. Everyone else has... I mean, it's believable, right? It's based on history, and a lot of these people have their pros and their cons, and they start good and turn bad, just like real people would, you know? Another cameo is from Diogenes. And Diogenes goes to a dinner party the and then just pees under the table on their legs. And
this is the guy who said, that doesn't seem time accurate, right? I thought he's from Alexander the Great period. I thought Alexander the Great comes to him and says, what can I give you? And the organist says, step aside, you're blocking the sun, or am I getting some philosophy?
That's wrong? True. I would need to look it up, but I can't be bothered. But I think that Diogenes was old at that point. Also, could it have been another Diogenes? But then, no, I don't think so. And
this is the guy who just doesn't care.
He wouldn't care
either. So that's the whole point. That is funny, it has the same camera. Yeah.
Some of the saddest scenes for me were actually the gambling scenes, where you see this guy, they keep giving him free alcohol and getting him to gamble away everything he has. He's borrowing money and they let him get into massive debt with them. They're letting him gamble for free and build up debts to the house so that they can then blackmail him and kill his father and everything else. And those are some really sad scenes, you know?
Okay.
And it estranges him from his family and all the rest of it. I didn't like those scenes. But Alex will tell you, I was reading this while I was with him. I read the first 200 pages during the trip to Athens. And then I increased my speed and finished the rest within a week after coming home. 100 pages.
Same like that.
Yeah. Fantastic book. And there's some photos on our Instagram at Books Boys Podcast of me reading this on the Acropolis beside the Parthenon. So
brilliant. And what did you read after that?
My next book I read, I thought, look, I couldn't read another 900-page book, right? I read a little book that's only 100 pages.
What?
And it's called
Stop it.
Brexit Unmasked.
All right. Yeah, you wrote to me about this, but I couldn't make my... I couldn't get an opinion about it. So
this is by a chap called Albert Kemp. He's in his 90s. He's an elderly gentleman. He's got military service and everything like that, but he's never written a book before, and he just decided he wanted to do almost like this is his public service, you know? It's a short book, it's about 100 pages. Half of it is actually about his own history, really. It's a little bit, starts with a bit of a memoir, which I suppose is giving him the authority to then say, here's why I'm now able to give my educated opinion on Brexit. And then the second half is basically him saying that Brexit was a disaster, right? And yeah, I'm not going to go too much into it because, you know, we don't usually like have political discussions on the show, but it was a nice book just to, it was quick. I read it in a day. It was informative. It was good, but it was also a bit of a palate cleanser after a 1,000-page book. You need to read something short. And
all right, again, fair enough, yeah. Okay, cool.
One or two quick, I mean, he mentions obviously the downsides of Brexit, which we all know about. One or two things that were mentioned that I would never have known. He mentions that when they did a survey of Northern Europe, 9 out of the 10 poorest regions were in the UK, one of which was Northern Ireland.
Already?
I would never have known. Oh, one was in Belgium and the other 9 were all in the UK. Yeah. I would never have known that. And that was, you know, only a decade ago, I think. So there's a lot of things like, you know, there's some good little pieces of information in there that I wouldn't have known about.
Compact, yeah, in a compact.
Yeah. The one thing I disagree with him on is he doesn't like the idea of a referendum at all as part of democracy because he basically says, I've seen this firsthand. I was in the wars and, you know, Hitler used referendums basically to get some of the things he wanted. And he's let that kind of corrupt his idea of a referendum in general. I personally think that it's a good piece of democracy. You know, so that's like the one main...
I would have thought so, yeah.
That's our one main disagreement. But he trashes the whole take back control stuff and get Brexit done and all the rest of it. And, you know, that's fine. I think it's a good book if you're interested. If you want to, you know, if you're interested in Brexit and you just want to read 50 pages about it, it's actually it's really, really good. So I'll hold on a second there now, PJ. I think
what's going on?
Telephone is just ringing. Bear with me. We'll just see who's on the line here.
Back in a second then.
Hello, you're through to Books Boys. You've got Dean on the line. Can I ask who's calling?
Yeah.
Albert, we were just talking. This is Albert Kemp. We were just chatting about your book there, Brexit Unmasked, on the show. So it's very fortuitous that you've called in. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you.
Good, good. Albert, I was just chatting to my co-host PJ a little bit about Brexit Unmasked. I read it this week. Fantastic book. I want to ask you one or two things about it. The first thing I'd like to ask, I mean, you said in the book, but just for the benefit of the listeners, what really prompted you to write this? You know, a lot of people have been upset and frustrated since Brexit happened over these last few years. What was the thing that just made you think, right, I have to get this down, you know, on paper?
Yeah, what really tipped me over the edge was the failure of our opposition leading politicians in Parliament to actually tell what I consider to be the truth about Brexit, the amount of damage that it was doing to the UK economy and to national prestige in general. And they were keeping silent about it, but the reason is they seem to think that Brexit would damage their election prospects. I don't believe that personally, but that seems to be what was behind it. But I then felt that if they weren't prepared to speak about it, I would have to try to write something myself.
Yourself, yeah. And I think that's fair. And, you know, you're right. I don't go into my political opinions in the show too often, but just since we are talking about it this month, you know, I think there is a lot of frustration about Brexit, and there is a lot of this idea that maybe the truth wasn't always told. And, you know, you hear about the likes of Boris Johnson with the, you know, the buses that had the slogans on them, 150 million for the NHS every week or whatever it was. And, you know, most of the stuff they said turned out to be either misdirection or occasionally just flat out lies by the sounds of things. So I think it is good that someone's kind of put some of the information together and sort of thought, right, it is time to get this out and actually spread some awareness to the public. So I think it's a good thing you've done.
Well, I think it's particularly important to the younger people in the UK, because a lot of their rights that they had have been really taken away from them. Often, you know, the ones that weren't old enough to vote in the referendum, you know, they had no chance to have an input. And what has happened is that it's been made a great deal more difficult for young people to travel backwards and forwards to the in the way that they used to when we were members of the EU. If they're members of a literary group, a pop group, or classical music, or whatever, you all those things are much more difficult now for them to just go over to the continent and give their concerts and that kind of thing than they used to be. So it does affect people quite considerably.
I've heard people involved in the arts, and in particular, music touring, as you say, with that complaint. I suppose my question would be to you, can you, I mean, I think that there's the disadvantages, I think, are obvious, right? I live in Northern Ireland, so we have been an area that has had a lot of issues regarding Brexit, and there's been backstops, and there's been, at the moment, we don't even have a functioning assembly at the moment because of it all. The DUP were involved, as you talk about in the book. There's a, you know, so we were kind of a front line in a lot of the arguments that were going on regarding trying to get things working with the EU. So I've seen the brunt of what's happening. Would you say that there is any positive aspect to Brexit? Because I struggle to find one.
I don't think there are any positive aspects whatsoever, to be quite honest. I've looked very carefully at what, whenever they suggest something, there's always a lack of real evidence for it. Not a single version of Brexit ever was ever backed up by an economic model, for example. When some of them were talking about a no deal Brexit, that surely should have been backed up. If they want us to leave something where we're doing perfectly well, which was the case actually in for something that is quite nebulous and not really clear at all, they certainly they should have put forward decent economic models, but they didn't. And I think the reason is they knew perfectly well they wouldn't stand up. Simple as that.
And you discussed there was different options. There was the no deal option, the kind of Canada style system, the Chequers. So, you discussed these in the book, and that there were different percentages given for how much the economy would be predicted to decline based on the which model they went with. But of course, those were all estimates and whatever. But the thing that was interesting to me was every forecast was like, well, if we do this, it'll only hurt us this much, not as bad as the other options. And I'm thinking, okay, where's the proposition that we do something that actually benefits us? It almost seemed that we just accepted we were gonna take a hit economically.
Well, I think a lot of people, they during the referendum campaign, the Brexiteers really concentrated on trying to make it appear a very simple matter and, if possible, a one subject thing. And they got on to eventually take back control, which was take back control of your borders. And they tried to, which wasn't accurate at all, actually, but in point of fact, a lot of people believed it. And they concentrated on that, and far more people went along with that than any other form, any other reason. In point, it was as I had suggested in earlier correspondence, it didn't hold up at all because quite certainly we needed the EU workforce that were coming here, and it was a kind of workforce that could come, do the jobs, go back to go to another EU country, but it's quite flexible. Whereas what we're having to do now is important people from much further away, and in many cases they won't want to leave the UK at the end of their sessions. I saw,
It's interesting you say that, Albert, because I remember when COVID hit, and obviously you talk about that in the book as well, but when COVID hit and we had been doing Brexit, and a lot of Europeans were discouraged from coming, and then all of a sudden, Boris Johnson and his administration say, oh, we have a health crisis. We'd like to encourage some, nurses and things from abroad to come. And I just thought to myself, you've made your own bed here. Like, you don't deserve them right now. You've done everything you can to discourage people from coming, And now that you've got a health crisis, you want to say, okay, quickly, we need you again. It's like, that doesn't work like that.
No, definitely not. No, you're perfectly 100% correct there. And there was no real understanding by the public at large of the benefits that we were getting from being in the EU, because they simply weren't being told. You know, the only kind of publicity that the EU ever got in our national press, for the most part, was publicity was detrimental to the EU. Nothing good was hardly ever said about it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you talk to people about the four freedoms, that we had with the with our access to the single market, for example, most people, they just eyes would just glaze over. They hadn't the faintest idea of what you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a widespread, it's not ignorance at all, it's just that they people had never been told. They just didn't know that just how important it was to our economy.
Yeah, I think that people didn't... I've always felt like we didn't talk a lot about the EU until Brexit, you know? And it's interesting, when I go to other places in Europe, I've seen European flags, I hear people refer to themselves as Europeans, European citizens. I've never heard that here. We didn't, obviously, weren't in the Schengen area, we didn't use the euro. I feel like the UK has always felt a little bit distanced. So that played into this idea that people didn't really know what the benefits of being in the EU were. And I think you're absolutely right on that.
Yeah, it was very unfortunate, I think. But on the other hand, I don't think the Remain campaign was anywhere near as good as it should have been.
No.
For one thing, they should have confronted them on the immigration issue head on. And they could have, that would have been, in point of it, really, there should never have been a referendum, as I think you would have seen in the book.
Mm-hmm.
There was an easy way, in my opinion, for the Prime Minister of the time, David Cameron, to put an end to the entire thing. He should have thrown the gauntlet down to them, to the people that were demanding a referendum in his own party, and people like Nigel Farage, who was heading UKIP at the time, and dared them to pick it up and say, look, you want Brexit, provide real economic evidence that it would be either beneficial to the country or at least wouldn't be detrimental. And that's what you've got to do before we can possibly have a referendum. Now, as I said in the book, you weren't elected to play Russian roulette with the UK economy. And I think he was quite wrong to go ahead with it.
Yeah, I feel I've always felt like it was this fear of the more extremists in UKIP. And I honestly don't think David Cameron ever thought it would happen. You know, he originally delayed doing the referendum. Then he, elect me for a second time and I'll do it. He finally did it and then immediately quit when, as you mentioned in the book, when the result kind of went the way it did. I think he thought he was calling their bluff and it just failed miserably.
Well, I'm quite certain that he did expect to win it, but he shouldn't have done, because he knew that the economic argument for remaining in was great. It was overpowering, really, and that should have been enough to swing the referendum in his favour. But most people didn't know, didn't understand that, and they certainly weren't helped much by the Remain campaign and the way that they conducted it.
Yeah, I know you weren't in favour of the referendum. I personally have no problem with referendums as being part of democracy, but I would have liked to see a second referendum done. And I know there was a lot of talk about that at the time. And my reason for it was just that I felt that with it being so close and with a lot of people, it only took a few people to have changed their minds. And I think that based on the amount of lack of information and misinformation in the run-up to it and in the campaign, I really feel like, a lot of people enough people would have changed their minds to invalidate the results. And with the seriousness of what we were doing, I think it was worth putting that to the test. And if you really believe people want it, you should be able to vote on it again, because you'll get the result, if you're that confident. But we never did.
Well, having had the first referendum, I've no doubt whatsoever that we should have had the, or it would have been the third referendum, actually.
Because
people seem to forget that we have one in 74.
The original one, yeah.
But, okay, but ignoring that, we should have had another referendum, because by 2019, there were clear indications that a majority of people were against Brexit. The polls were saying that, and that was very clear when, you know, I mentioned in the book I worked out on stores in a very anti-Brexit county. Every single district in this county voted Leave when in the referendum, and yet on the stores that I was working on, we were getting more votes for end Brexit and revoke Article 50 than for the all of the Brexit propositions, which we also had down on a, you know, sheet put together. Yeah.
Then when you add in the mass of, you know, Boris Johnson proroguing Parliament early and all that kind of stuff, the whole business seemed very shady to me at the time. But Albert, let me ask you this. Is this a once and done, you know, you had some stuff to say, you've said it, you're done, or, you know, are you still planning to write something more?
Well, to be honest, I'm 95 now, and I really haven't got the, you know, the incentive and impetus to do. I think I've done my bit now, and I want the. I would like this to get a decent airing among a few people, quite a lot of people, particularly the younger generation.
Yeah,
because you know they're the ones that are being affected, but the entire country is obviously. The economy would have taken knocks, let's be frank about it, from the COVID and from the Ukraine
situation. Yeah, yeah.
But nevertheless, when we had a good, firm economic base, we could take those in our stride and come out after, you know, after a period of time, and we'd be back to a decent position again economically. But by destroying what was our a really good position, which we had, people don't seem to understand that it was being presented also by the Brexiteers as an either or situation where you could either trade with the EU or you could trade globally. Well, this was absolute rubbish.
Of course. But you mentioned that, yeah.
People didn't understand that. A lot of the people that I spoke to had no idea, you know, that the tragedy was that the EU referendum was written just at a time when some very major trade deals that the EU had been years in the negotiating were just about to come on stream. You know, I refer, you know, to the one with Japan, for example, which would have given the EU tremendous opportunities, particularly in the services sector, which was our main exporter. And instead of that, of course, we had, you know, countries that had opened up manufacturing plants in cars and pharmaceuticals, that kind of thing, major countries, all queuing up to leave, basically. I think Nissan has only remained because they've given it such a good sweetener, you know, to compensate for the amount of tariffs that were going to be put onto their cars if they tried to export to the EU. That is really what's persuaded them to stay. Otherwise, they would have left as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because I do sometimes feel like I'm living in a country that went from being very strong and respected on a global stage to living in a country that is essentially in decline, you know, and that's kind of, and if that's what the UK wanted, then I guess they've only got themselves to blame in a way. But again, I do feel there was a lot of misinformation and everything. But look, let me wrap up. I'll put a link to the book and to your, you know, where people can go and buy it and things like that in the show notes. But we ask every author one question, and I'll ask you this question. Aside from the book you've already written, of course, if there's one book that already exists and that you wish you had been the person to write, what would it be?
Well, I like the book from Suez to... Well, it's really an I would be interested in writing historical accounts of and that's really what interests non-fiction is what interests me most. And they I saw read a really good book which was took us from the Suez fiasco back in 1956 up until the Brexit leaving the EU. I thought it was very well written, and I would love to have written
Okay. Very good. Well, Albert, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. I enjoyed the book, and I think you've done your service. I mean, you mentioned in the earlier parts of the book the, working in the Home Office and serving in the military and all the actual service that you did for us a long time ago. But I think this book is a very recent contribution, which I think that you should be commended for, and for putting some important messages out there. So thank you very much. And thank you for calling into the show.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to air my views.
No problem. Take care. Have a good evening. Bye-bye. Well, there
Bye-bye.
we go. Thank you so much. And unexpectedly, early in the show as well, Albert Kemp calling in to chat about Brexit Unmasked. I do recommend the book. And as I said,
Thanks
he's
very much.
95 years old.
So a lot of respect for writing that, yeah.
Yeah.
Just
PJ,
wanting to
why don't we
express your
hear from
opinion.
something you've read?
Well, let me tell you about a beautiful book, and you might remember who this chap is. It's Dino Buzzati. Remember when after my Italy trip, when I came back and I talked
Yes,
about Dino Buzzati's short story,
I do. I
and
vaguely recall.
yeah, so it was the Boutique of Mysteries. It was a short collection
Yes,
story.
the title I do remember.
Yeah, so Dino Buzzati is an Italian writer from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and yeah, I just really love the short stories. There were some stories that really stayed with me, including The Seven Messengers, where basically a prince decides to look for the limits of his father's kingdom, and he just never gets there, but he doesn't stop either. He just keeps going because he thinks it's going to end soon. And he sends back messengers, seven messengers, and they just never come back. Well, they do come back, but eventually it takes 20 years for the next one to come back. And he's out of contact with his family, it's said in old times. And they're very mysterious kind of tales that are magic realist and absurdist at some points. But Il Segreto del Bosco Vecchio, and I don't think it has been translated into English. None of them were. It's the secret of the old forest. And again, guys, we're just recommending books. We seem to be half the books we recommend are just not published in English. But the famous invasion of the bears in Sicily is a more famous children's book he wrote, and it's been translated. But this one was his first one, and I think his second novel. It is absolutely beautiful. It's really before he became famous as a short story writer, and it's about. It's very magic realist, I suppose, and but it's more fairy tale-esque than your average Latin American magic realist, or even more Camus or Salman Rushdie.
And does it have dialogue, PJ?
It has dialogues. You would enjoy this. It has dialogues. Now, I suppose actually, to be fair, Nadine, if I look at it, it does have a lot of description. It does have dialogue too. It is essentially a children's story, and it reads like a children's story too. It's beautiful, clear Italian, and yeah, I'm very into children's books at the moment myself, in minimalism as well, so it's good in that. It basically starts off with Colonel Sebastiano Broccolo, who comes to stabilize himself, it says here, or to ground himself in the Valley of Fondo in the spring of 1925, a bit before this book was written, so set a bit in the past of when the time was written. And the colonel Sebastiano Broccolo is really someone who has really lost touch of his inner child. You know, I
Of
love to talk about
course.
that. But this is why I do love the book. The forest is alive. And he's basically come here to live because he has gotten part of the forest is from an uncle, I believe, after the uncle died. However, the larger part of the forest is now owned by the colonel's nephew. And the problem is, the nephew, Benvenuto, is just a lovely kind of innocent soul, really. You know, he doesn't want to harm or use or abuse the forest. or take advantage of its resources. But of course, the Colonel, being an adult, that's basically the message here, does want to take advantage of it. However, it's and the Colonel is kind of like a person you would expect from an adult existentialist novel, like Alain Camus or Sartre. Someone's very distant from himself. You have no idea really what he's feeling. There's a lot of observational descriptions of him. He's essentially the protagonist, which is odd because he's also so clearly not the protagonist, which is it's he's the person that spent most time describing, but he doesn't really do anything. He's kind of like trying to do stuff and with the forest, and the forest is just always overpowering him because it's alive. So he's always trying to cut the wood or change things, and it just doesn't end up quite working because everything's alive. So everything's being personified here. In the wind, the forest, it's like the trees, even the house where he lives in, sometimes things talk there. And there's also a tyrannical mouse living there who wants to keep a mattress for himself. There is a lot of, you could almost say, cute kind of animalism going on, except it's not really cute. It's not even that the animals are always that nice, as you would sort of expect from a children's animal, from a children's animal book, I suppose. The character I like probably the most, I do love Procola because he's such a distant chap, and at the same time, emotion stirs up with him from time to time, and he doesn't allow it. He doesn't kind of allow it, so I kind of find it very interesting. That's his story, basically. I haven't finished it, by the way, so I can't spoil it. I wouldn't spoil it. But essentially, it's him trying to take over the forest, and it's a bit futile. But a more serious thing happens, I suppose, and this is kind of more the what gets you going if you feel a bit maybe bored from the pastoral scenes. He does want to kill the nephew. So there's a brilliant chapter which just ends with the phrase, and then he realized all of a sudden he actually wants Benvenuto dead. It's a bit of a surprise feeling for him. He just wants to get there. He wants to, I suppose the main reason is he wants to get the whole forest for himself. But I also think he might be jealous of him because the forest loves the child. Well, the animals, they play with him and everything. But everyone is distant to Sebastiano. And now here's where it gets interesting. There is a wind called Matteo, the wind Matteo, il vento Matteo, and he's used to be the wind of the valley. So he used to be kind of something like a mayor, or kind of, or at least more of a dictator, really, because he wasn't that nice a wind. He kind of was very strong, destroying things. And so they managed then to lock him up in a well. However, Sebastiano releases him with making him promise that if I release you and make you free, you will do whatever I say. And Matteo promises. And Matteo is delighted he's free again, and he immediately sets off to kill the boy, almost immediately, because that's what Sebastiano wants. But he realizes then quite soon he can't do it. He's too weak. He hasn't exercised, I suppose, for a while. And then it doesn't help that there's another wind who's already in control of the valley, and he, and things happen, and he's obviously not as respected then in the end as he is anymore. And this is what's interesting because this is set just before, or maybe actually, I don't know if Mussolini was in power. I think it's just before Mussolini gets into power. And you can see that both Sebastiano Procolo is a Mussolini figure, but I would say that Matteo is not Mussolini. Matteo is just your average, strong, kind of working man who gets influenced by fascism and then does what the fascist tells him. So Sebastiano Procolo has no muscle, but he just dictates, and
And
Matteo
it is
just
easy to
listens.
get influenced by these systems and by the societal movements and powerful speakers and things like that. So we always have to allow a little bit of empathy for individuals, I think, sometimes.
Exactly. But what I love about the book, I'm not sure it's going to end yet, but it is beautiful just that the things the forest say, they do try to help the man. They kind of forgive him and the wind constantly in their naivety and stupidity. And they just go and they just kind of always show it. The book just shows though them that nature will always, nature versus nurture large, nature will always prevail. That's the message of the book. And also, it's just also just beautiful pastoral scenes of the boy playing around. And it's got, you would like this, Dean. It's got Dean Buzzati's own illustrations in the book, which I find just very kind of mystical, just very kind of slightly abstract scenes from the forest it's set in. And it's a very minimal kind of fairy tale book, very conscious, I find. Yeah, this is the kind of children book I'm looking at.
Nice.
So I highly recommend it. I can't tell you how it ends, but I hope you will look up Dino Buzzati. He's definitely got a lot of other books released in English, and they're always very thought provoking. I'd say very, very kind of, I don't know, like I just love it. I just love his writing. I enjoyed the short stories. I'm really loving this novel at the moment.
Okay.
So Dino Buzzati, The Secret of the Old Forest.
Brilliant. Well, I might just take a quick moment. That sounds very interesting, by the way. Quick moment to mention to everyone that you can find, of course, our website at booksboys.com. And, of course, if you go to us on Patreon, patreon.com/booksboys, you can not only get Books Boys early, but you can also get all of our other shows. For example, I've been putting up some music archives every month as Music Man. We've got Dark Place Dreamers. Robert and I started a new series. We're reviewing the 80s show, Hammer House of Horror. And we've got a couple of episodes released. I think we've recorded 4 episodes. And of course, Alex and I, we're still working on Playboys. We're doing our ancient Greek plays. And we finished a few comedies. And we started our first tragedy, which was Prometheus Bound. And we might do a little bonus episode to review our performance of Tartuffe that we're going to see tomorrow. So you might get that.
Nice.
See how we feel.
Cultural Latin, tiger.
Mm-hmm.
Very cultural.
And I suppose while we're talking about it, I might as well play the little ad that we have for Patreon.
Sweet, let's dance.
Let's dance.
Oh yeah.
The fact that we'll be
is PJ.
Hello there.
Now PJ, what have we learned about Shakespeare?
He's a heart attack!
Hello. Dark Place Robert, I'm playing with Alex.
Doing all right, glad to be here again.
So I've given you those nicknames. I'm not a fan of that one. Well, that's where people will know you from. That's why
you're gonna know me from that one, but let's carry on anyway.
Hello there, can you hear me?
Join us for Shakespeare written, Spanish plays and poetry, rock star interviews, film reviews, Dark Place Dreamers, and more. Patreon.com/booksboys. There we go. And I actually did a new Film Fellows as well, reviewing Ricky Gervais' Life on the Road. So,
nice.
Content.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.